Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
McGill.
And it is the 1st of August, 2023, and we are recording episode 158 today. McGill, I understand you've been real busy, been having a lot of people over. I've been going over to people's places. I played this game. This game's so dark and so edgy and so disturbing. You gotta have like a million content warnings on it. It's called Cult Divinity Lost.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say Hole.
Oh man, I wish I was playing something like that. Although Cult Divinity Lost, it wasn't bad. It was just, I'll tell you. So it was funny. I played, it was a little one-shot. It's like an introductory thing for the game called The Driver. And it's very improvisational. And it's just like, it's for a GM and one player. And so two things about it I'll say. One is when it's a spooky game where you're just like in a horror scenario, basically, there's a certain anxiety that builds that is like, there's no direction except into the horror, you know? You can't just like be like, no, and leave the spooky house, or, you know, like something's always gonna get you. And so there's a certain thing of like, well, it doesn't really matter if I make the right choice here, because the choice that I make is always going to lead me deeper into this spooky, haunted horror scenario, right?
It's so funny that you say this, Tom. I'm not going to go off on a tangent here, but maybe I'll talk a bit about it after you're done. I recently just played through a video game called The Quarry, which is one of those super massive games, the people who do the Dark Pictures Anthology, and that's exactly what it is. It's an interactive horror movie game, and because the game has to keep the plot moving forward, it's just a game where, as you said, you just have no choice but to go deeper and deeper into the horror.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely something about it. Like, I don't feel, because there's something about that when it's a role-playing game, and certainly when it's like a GM and one player, is like there's a certain consensual arrangement to that where it's like I am agreeing that we are playing a horror game and therefore every step I make is further into the horror. It's just like there's a certain freedom that almost kind of robs you of, where it's not like you're playing like a regular D&D character where it's like anything, any idea you come up with can go here. It's like there's a certain level where your power fantasy is restricted to like, oh god, well, I know I shouldn't go in the house, but I've got no choice, I gotta go into the house.
It's kind of like, because there are only two players, you know, the GM and the single player character, it becomes sort of an improv game of yes and. You never want to, like, block the story from moving forward, even if your character would be like, I'm getting the hell out.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. The other thing, so what was funny was, you know, part of this was to sort of test out for a potential game that we'd run with more people later. And I said at some point, like, man, from this experience, I'm starting to think that, like, it's not the disturbing content or anything that's going to be a problem for this game. The problem for this game is going to be my character constantly just, like, pratfalling all over themselves and making the game into an accidental comedy and, like, ruining the horror vibe of the game. Because my character could not succeed at anything they attempted, man. I rolled so many failures that night, and we found out why afterwards later, is that, so this is a Powered by the Apocalypse game, but this one, it doesn't use D6s, it used D10s, but we were using D6s, so I was rolling like dice sizes lower than I was supposed to be the whole time, which was honestly a relief to find out, because I was like, okay, I was worried that this game was just kind of like, the cards were so stacked against me that it was like sort of miserable comedy of errors where I just like keep failing.
It's like failing the QuickTime events in the quarry.
Yeah, only have a lot of trouble doing any of them, I guess. McGill, I guess you don't have much role-playing game news to cover lately because you've been so busy and all that.
But I do have a final follow-up to a topic that has been brought up more than once on the show, which is I finally got around to playing Dust Runner.
Oh, yeah.
I'm pleased to report it's really cool. It's funny because the package is, like, it's almost all cards. Most of the game is made of different types of cards. And there are two minifigs of, like, Mad Max vehicles, and there's some dice and a few tokens. But it's mostly using the cards, except in practice, it's actually a lot more like a board game, where you make a board using cards that form essentially the Fury Road, the path that you're going to be racing down to try to get away from the raiders. As we mentioned before, your stats of your car are represented by cards, but you lay them out, like you flip them over to pick different car parts to build your car, but then you lay it out and it's almost like a character sheet or like a little, you know, some board games. I'm thinking of something like, Last Night on Earth, where they have like a little cardboard character sheet, I guess Arkham Horror probably has that too. So the cards that you use to make your vehicle are like that. And then, all the other cards in the game are kind of like a dungeon crawl, like a dungeon crawl deck. And so, the way it works is you build your map, the path that you race down, you build your car that gives you, depending on the parts you choose, you get different health, you get different fuel amounts, and you get different ammo amounts. And then, when it's your turn, you flip over a card from one of the two central decks, and that card will tell you either an encounter you have or an enemy you fight. The encounters are usually things like gas station, pay one fuel to move your car ahead two spaces, or ambulance, gain three health, things along those lines. And then there are also enemy cards that come up. And when you draw that card on your turn, you actually draw two cards face down and you turn one up, and then you have the option of flipping over the other. But if you do that, you gotta go with the second card no matter what it is. And when you fight the enemies, something that I thought was really interesting about the design of the game is there is one of the two decks. There's the exploration deck where you draw these events and enemies. And then there's the resolution deck, which is a all the cards in the resolution deck are multi-purpose. On any given card, it will tell you how much health an enemy will get, how much damage you will do to the enemy, what loot you will get if you match a symbol with one on the enemy card, and how many spaces the enemy will move. But you use different parts of those cards at different times. So if you draw an enemy, you draw from the resolution deck and note the enemy health. And also those cards also tell you who goes first, you or the enemy. So you note the enemy health, you put a die on the enemy card to represent that health, and then initiative is determined. And if you go first, you basically have to decide how many ammo you're going to spend to try and kill the opponent. Sometimes you can get them in one go. Sometimes it'll be multiple rounds. When you spend an ammo, what it does, it doesn't tick off points from your opponent's health. When you spend an ammo, that is one card drawn from the resolution deck. So effectively, you know, I spend three ammo, I draw three cards, and then I note where on each of those cards it says how much damage I do and stack them all together for a total amount that's being dealt to the enemy.
So if you think you could take them out in one shot, you could spend one ammo and hope that you get a good card?
Yes, exactly that. Or you could hedge your bets, spend a bunch of ammo to overkill it with a pile of cards and make sure you have enough damage to take out the enemy. Once that's done, you then draw another card, and if there's like a symbol on that card, if that symbol matches with the symbol that is on the enemy card, you get some loot. You get whatever loot is on the resolution card, and you automatically get any loot that's on the enemy you killed. And then that resolution card will also say how many spaces the raiders move. So it's like the card that is pursuing you gets to catch up because you were busy fighting an ambush. That's sort of the in-game logic to it. So when you fight, the enemy car that's chasing you moves ahead to pursue you because you've been waylaid. And then this game loop proceeds all the way until like you get killed or you reach your home base at the finish of the map. And then throughout the game, all these different actions and the different parts in your car and everything, all of them contribute to a total of victory points at the end of the game. And then you can sort of score yourself on the scorecard to just see, like, you beat the game, but how well did you beat it? How many victory points did you get? Very fun. Of the two, I feel like, you know, I got Doom Machine and Dust Runner, and of the two, I feel like Doom Machine is the more addictive game. It's the one that I kept going back to going like, no, I want to play another game and try and beat the Doom Machine. But Dust Runner, I think, has really fantastic flavor. It's really cool for like this little self-contained game. And just big recommendations for both those games. And I'm totally going to, I already know I'm going to spend more money at thegamecrafter.com on more of these mint tin solo card games. The next one I'm looking at is called Tin Helm, and it's by the same guy who made Dust Runner, and it's an actual dungeon crawl in a box. Each card is like a room in a dungeon. The backs of the cards tell you like what enemies are there, what loot is there. Looks really fun and tight, and I know I'm going to buy it at some point. But yeah, really great stuff. Dust Runner and Doom Machine, I give big recommendations to.
Cool. I had something to bring to the podcast. We've been talking last episode about, is there a Palladium actual play podcast? McGill, there is.
Yeah, Beyond you found Earths, it.
Beyond Earths, a Palladium Megaverse actual play podcast. Now, the one trick is they don't appear to play riffs.
Yeah, I don't know that they've ever played riffs. This is the sticking point for me. I'm saying sticking point too many times, but I see here like they're doing like Heroes Unlimited.
Well, so they did there. It's the Spotify archive of their episode sort of starts midway through a season where they're doing Dead Rain, which is the zombie one. It's one of the more recent Palladium games, more recent, like, you know, in the order of their release. Then they go to Heroes Unlimited, and now currently they are playing Palladium Fantasy Role-Playing First Edition, which they're into the 60s in episodes. They just had one on July 28th. So at the very least, we can say that there is an ongoing Palladium Megaversal RPG game going on. It's just that they do seem to split the Megaverse into specific seasons depending what they're covering. And yeah, the big one, as we say, isn't there. So it sounds like you're dissatisfied, McGill. It sounds like you won't rest until I'm running the Riffs podcast.
I mean, I wouldn't be disappointed, Tom, but no, that is not secretly my mission. But I am dissatisfied because, I don't know, I guess I gotta talk to more role players or something. I gotta go down to the local game store and talk to some folks there about this who have been playing RPGs for as long as we have, because, as I said before, I feel like Rifts, in my mind, is one of those bigger games. Like, you know, when I think of role-playing games in general, D&D, of course, World of Darkness, specifically Vampire the Masquerade is the one that really comes to mind for me, and Rifts, but I mean, maybe that's just because Rifts was my introduction to RPGs. Of course, Rifts does have like maybe a gazillion freaking books.
Yeah, I was gonna say maybe it's because they took up so much space at the game store.
Yeah, they had enormous racks of books at Fandom too. But All that to say, here we are in 2023, people still talking about Vampire the Masquerade, people playing, like, D&D, I feel, is almost more popular than ever at this point. There was just a Dungeons & Dragons movie. But where the heck is Rifts in all of this? Why did it fade away? I don't understand.
We didn't talk about the other Dungeons & Dragons movie that way. There was just a Dungeons & Dragons movie! No, let's not mention the other one.
Yes, the less said about the other one, the better. But, I mean, there are actually, I think, three D&D live-action movies. One went straight to video. I've never seen it. I know very little about it. But, like, D&D has three movies. Vampire the Masquerade had a TV series. Where's Rifts? Rifts had that game for, like...
Rifts had a Nokia N-Gage game,
that's
yeah.
Right. Nokia N-Gage. That's it.
Man, I saw something crazy recently as well that was like something on the N-Gage that I was like, was it? Oh, I think it might have been an Elder Scrolls game that was on the N-Gage. Anyway, I was like, what the heck is this? Since when?
But why is nobody, why is there no Rifts podcast? Where's my Rifts podcast?
I mean, man. I feel
especially like Beyond Earths, it's so weird that they don't even do Rifts on this one. Wasn't Rifts like one of the banner games for Palladium?
Oh yeah, like I do think it's very I don't know, it definitely jumps out at me that they have not played Rifts. They've played Dead Rain, Heroes Unlimited, and Fantasy. Like, yeah, that does seem like a glaring decision. And so I'm not sure what their reasons for it are. Definitely on my part, I think about it and I'm like, Rifts is big. Like, how would... I feel like I'd have to drill down on such a specific part of the setting just to, like, feel like I had a comprehensive knowledge of what I was doing. Do you know what
You'd
I mean?
You'd have to focus on one world book.
Yeah, like one place in one world book, probably. I don't know.
Anyway, I haven't had a chance to listen to Beyond Earths, but have you?
I listened to a little bit of it. I was sort of jumping around because I had listened to a bit of the newest episode, and then I went back and listened to the start of the season where they start playing Palladium Fantasy RPG. But like I said, there's a lot of episodes in there. So yeah, barely scratched the surface, unfortunately. What have you even got for us today, McGill?
Am I up first? You want me to go first?
You don't have to. I'm just curious.
No,
what
no,
you
let's do it. Let's do it because I effectively brought a like sampler platter. As we've been saying, I've been real busy entertaining so many guests. I haven't had time yet to go through gates. I haven't had time to like buckle down and look at a lot of RPGs. But I've got a bunch of bookmarks that are on my list. So hopefully next time I'm going to bring something a little more interesting. But you know what I did find is I found how many of these? I found 14 one-page RPGs by Oliver Darkshire. Does that name ring a bell to you?
Well, only because you put it in the notes for the episode, is this is the guy who did the Trapped in a Cabin with Lord Byron.
That's right. And how did I even find it? It was just like in my regular internet browsing, I randomly stumbled upon another one-page RPG along those same lines called Trapped in Your House Due to Hans Christian Andersen. Hans Christian Andersen is on your lawn. He won't leave, and you refuse to let him in. Surely he has to go home eventually. Surely? Why does he have camping supplies with him? And after I looked, like, after I stumbled on Trapped in Your House Due to Hans Christian Andersen, I started digging deeper, and it turns out that Oliver Darkshire, who I've discovered is a published author and also works for a book chain. Oliver has written loads of these one-page RPGs, and they all work on very similar systems. Like once you know the formula, you can see what's going on. There are a few variations, But they're all extremely fun. And so rather than go through like all 14 that I found, I figured I'd read out some of these titles, and then you can pick, you can stop me on any that you want to look at closer. Because they're all one page and they all use similar systems, I'm sure we can tear through a bunch of these. You ready?
Okay.
So, in alphabetical order, a consistent interpretation of the rules, a one-page RPG. Battle of the Brontes. Be Gay, Solve Crime. Bookstore. Exit Stage Left, Chased by a Bear. Homoerotic Space Wizards. I Do Not Want a Mastodon. The Last Days of Rome. Left Wing Office Cat. Pedro Pascal on the Run with a Magical Child. Here's one that's just called Potato. The Prime Minister Must Resign. I've already mentioned Trapped in a Cabin with Lord Byron and Trapped in Your House Due to Hans Christian Andersen. And finally, We Had to Kill Beatrix Potter.
Like, I'm interested relative to all these other ones what Last Days of Rome is like.
Okay.
But also, like, Homoerotic Space Wizards feels like kind of a counterpoint to Thirsty Sword Lesbians, so...
Oh, yeah, true. I hadn't considered that. Well, we can look at both of these. And I should also say, it's entirely possible, and in fact, extremely likely, that Oliver Darkshire has done even more one-page RPGs than these. These are just the ones that I could find through some basic search. So let's look at Last Days of Rome. You're a citizen in a relatively successful empire. Alas, the new emperor has arrived, and he's decided that the best thing for everyone would be to burn it all to the ground with you all still inside it. Nothing to be done but carry on as usual, you suppose. He is, after all, the emperor. Let me say, send this to you. So much like... This is very similar in layout, even, to Trapped in a Cabin with Lord Byron. You've got, like, tables, random tables on the right. You have three scores. They're not stats, they're just scores. And the game ends when scores hit different values. So you have three scores. Flames, Desolation, and Relocation all start at 0 and all go up to 10. To start the game, you generate a new city event by rolling a d6 and... there are city events in a table here. 1, 2, or 3 begins the city event with in the Imperial Palace. 4 or 5 is relative unrest. And 6 adds 1 to your flames score. If you're playing with other people, you can add 1 to someone else's flames score instead. So there's a competitive element if you play this multiplayer. So you first roll a 6-sided die to generate a city event. You adjust your scores as directed by the table or subtable, then roll a new event. Keep rolling new events until one of the following occurs. If your flame score reaches 10, your house is finally consumed by the spreading wildfires, and you are burned alive in the process. You saw it coming, of course. That knowledge comforts you. If your desolation score reaches 10, then society breaks down completely, and you are killed in the rampage. If it makes any difference to you, then you should know that there's no such thing as an emperor in a wasteland. He shall rule over ashes. If your relocation score reaches 10, you come to your senses and gather your belongings, striking out into the unknown. Maybe you'll find a better life out there, away from fiddling emperors. You'll probably be eaten by wolves, but you should take the chance. And there's an additional rule here. We should totally just kill Caesar. At any time, you can declare, we should totally just kill Caesar. Roll a number of d6 equal to the current number of your desolation score and add up the dice. If the result is 20 or more, then you assassinate the emperor. You die either way, but if you pull it off, then it will be immensely satisfying. And then the last parts are the two tables, one that begins with In the Imperial Palace, and one that begins with Relative Unrest. Each is a d6 table. All the different results add to your different scores. So it's just, like, this is, they call this an RPG. Oliver Darkshire calls this an RPG, but, and you could play it like one, but pretty clearly this is actually a lot like something like Doom Machine or Dust Runner, where you can just have fun rolling the dice and seeing how, you know, where the chips fall. Tom, let's generate a few of these events, shall we? Grab your D6.
Oh, boy. I'm going to burn down. I rolled a 5. That's relative unrest, right?
Yep.
Another 5. Is Rome really over? It's hard to say. Who knew burning a city took this long? Plus 1 desolation.
Yep. And, I mean, can roll a couple more.
A 4, that's more relative unrest.
Mm-hmm.
A 4 and a 4, lions are released onto the streets in an attempt to calm the population. Desolation and flames, so my desolation is up. 5 and 4, more lions, oh my god!
Just the streets are full of lions in the burning city.
So far, we're leading towards desolation, McGill.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to keep at it?
Sure, let's just do it until a score reaches 5. How about that? We'll do a half-size game.
I got a 1 in the Imperial Palace. The Emperor screams like a baby. Why does the world not bend to his whims? That's desolation for me. I'm almost at the 5 for desolation already.
Yeah, it's 4 desolation.
I receive a letter asking me to reassert my faith in the Emperor in writing. That's relocation. That's my first one on there. Oh, the Emperor fiddles with manic glee. It's not tuneful, plus 1 flames.
So is that 3 flames you got now?
2, I think.
Nope, cause the lions happened twice.
Yeah, and that has flames on it. So I got lions twice, and then Emperor fiddles with manic glee. Yeah,
so
right.
That's 3 flames.
I'm at 4 desolation and 3 flames.
Mm-hmm.
But I just got work continues on a house made of pure gold. It keeps melting. That's plus 1 flames. I'm now at 4 flames, 4 desolation, 1 relocation.
Oh, this could be the end.
This is the end. Oh, it's flames. The Emperor decrees that the burning will continue until morale improves. And that's where I burn down.
Your house is finally consumed by the spreading wildfires, and you're burned alive in the process. You saw it coming, and you did see it coming, Tom. You absolutely called that.
I kind of thought the desolation might get there first, but well, I don't know.
Well, right at the start, you said you were gonna burn down.
Oh
and
yeah,
so
that's
you
true.
Did.
That's true. This is just a game about burning down, though. There's not a lot of options.
So let's take a look at homoerotic space wizards now, and you'll see what I mean. Like, these all follow that template. Extremely similar. You're a space wizard and you have a nemesis who is an evil space wizard. He's hunting you and you should probably kill each other, but that would be simple, and you are very complex. You have 3 scores, once again. Lasers, pining, and hunted all start at 0. And this time there are 3 tables instead of 2. The tables are a remote encounter, another duel in space, or life on the run. Once again, on your turn, you roll a d6. 1 or 2 is a remote encounter, 3 or 4, a duel in space, 5 or 6, life on the run. The events in those subtables determine which scores go up, and the outcomes are as follows. If your laser's score reaches 10, then you finally take a lethal hit from the endless slew of gunfire aimed by poorly trained trooper or a laser sword. Your nemesis holds your body and weeps. If your pining score reaches 10, then you succumb to your urges, betray your principles, and join your nemesis. You rule space together evilly. If your hunted score reaches 10, then you find yourself cornered. No escape. This will be your last duel, or will it? You roll a d6, and there's a table with 6 results, or sorry, with 4 results on a d6 roll, and I'll just read them out. So, potential endings if your hunted score reaches 10. Your nemesis defeats you but lets you go. Reduce your hunted score by 3 and continue play. You defeat your nemesis, but you show mercy and they flee. Reduce your hunted score by 3 and continue play. Your nemesis has a change of heart and dies saving you from his own troops or some other disaster. Or you and your nemesis kill each other. It's poetic. You have time for an extended, agonizing goodbye.
I like this one because it's not just an inevitability that I'm just going to burn down.
I also like that the scores, the way they go up, is different. It's not just things going up by one every time. I see in some of these tables, you get plus two hunted, plus two pining. In another duel in space table, if you get into a fist fight, you get plus three pining, I guess, because your opponent really shows off his awesome muscles as he does so. Was he always this muscular, it says? So, yeah, let's do it again.
So am I doing it? All right, first up, we got another duel in space.
Oh.
For six, he demands I join him and forsake my allies. Never! I'm pining. Six, life on the run. I run away. One, I save some civilians, but it leaves a trail. I'm hunted. Plus one. Four,
so
another
you got one in each
space
now.
Duel. Three, we try and stab each other on a moving platform. That's lasers. Pew, pew, pew. Yeah, one in each. Three, as another duel in space. Four, sword fight over a lava pit. That's another lasers.
Wow, you try to stab each other on a moving platform, and then you have a sword fight over a lava pit. Which sci-fi movie is this, I wonder?
Life on the Run. Number four, I make a plucky friend, but they are slain defending me. More lasers. Oh no.
It's more lasers. You're one away from end lasers.
Three and three. Oh, we try and stab each other on a moving platform. And I get killed by a laser. I'm dead.
And yeah, so you finally took a lethal hit from your nemesis, who then holds your body and weeps. And that is Homoerotic Space Wizards. Do you want to do like one more of these, Tom, just for giggles?
What's I Don't Want a Mastodon like?
I think you can probably guess. Due to the unwanted and ill-judged generosity of a late relative's will and testament, you are now the owner of a large, bad-tempered proboscidian. I've never seen that word before. Proboscidian. No, you did not necessarily want a mastodon, but life gave you one anyway, and now it's in your house touching all your things. Once again, three scores. This time it's confusion, damages, and thinking. It's this like the same template. You roll on the mastodon events. There are then two tables to pick from. A day with your mastodon and an evening at home. If you roll a six on the events, you anger your mastodon with your questions and it sits on you. If you roll a d6 and if you roll a six, it squashes you permanently. You never emerge. And the win conditions are, if your confusion score reaches 10, you finally lose your temper with the wretched creature and confront it. The argument is brief because you have no idea what it's trying to tell you, and eventually it just crushes you to death using its trunk. If your damages score reaches 10, then you lose all your money and your livelihood is destroyed, reduced to a gigantic footprint in the ash. The mastodon abandons you in search of someone else to inconvenience. And if your thinking score reaches 10, you decide that mastodons are not for you. You slip away into the night with the last of your remaining savings, faking your death. Perhaps you'll build a gigantic pillow fort or collect tumblers. Something quiet. And then, this has a special rule, a feverish moment of dire clarity. Whenever you gain confusion, roll 3d6. If all the dice land on the same number, you finally decipher what the mastodon was trying to tell you. You live the rest of your life in a state of blissful enlightenment, in harmony with your new friend. And you're also a vegan now.
Do I have to play this one? I feel like I get the idea.
No, you don't have to play this
one.
Yeah. I'd, you know what? Roll. Do three rolls. Let's generate some of that anyway.
Okay. One, a day with my mastodon. The mastodon won't move unless I know the password, and I don't know the password. That's confusion. Roll some 3d6. Nope. Nothing. Haven't come to any big outcomes like that. Four, an evening at home. Two, it wears so many hats. How will you wash all these hats? More confusion.
This one's much more absurdist than the other ones.
Yeah.
Somehow, even more.
Oh my god,
absurdist.
I almost got 3 twos, but I got a 2, a 2, and a 3. I almost had a moment of confusion of clarity with my mastodon. I think I get the idea. I was wondering if this was going to be set in like primal times or something, but I guess
no,
I answered my question.
That's exactly it. And yeah, as you said, like, you get it now. There's Pedro Pascal on the run with a magical child, has events like the child gets their hands on some kind of lethal weapon, or you make food and there's a small chance that it's lethal. The child uses their powers to save your life and it's messy. That kind of thing. Which one was it that had... It wasn't this one. There was... Oh, Be Gay, Solve Crime. Has an additional component to it that's different than the others, which is it's a whodunit. So whenever you mark a point of murder, which is one of the three scores, cross a suspect off the list. That means they're dead. If all the guests are murdered except one, then you've found the murderer on a technicality, but you've done a bad job as a detective. So it has a different win condition where every time you gain a point in one of your three scores, you cross off a suspect from the list, thereby narrowing down who the murderer would be. But yeah, they're all just kind of like this. I think they're very amusing, but like you, I also feel like you get it. We don't actually necessarily need 15 of these, but it's pretty fun. I don't know. What do you think?
Good on him for making a whole bunch of things out of one little idea. That's cool. I don't know. It's not really for me. It's not something I'd care to play.
Well, we just did. Like, that's it. We did it. We did it. But yeah, I think these are pretty fun. And I will say that looking through these, I found more one-page RPGs that are not using this template, done by different people, that I will probably bring to future RPG games.
Yeah, I know. I think there's like an annual contest where it's like everybody, it's like a day when everybody's challenged to like make a one-page RPG. I seem to remember something about that. So, are we getting back to my game of Coyote's Aegis, my Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition campaign?
Well, that's all for me, so yeah, let's check in with Coyote's Aegis. All
right, so, when we left off, we had just finished Operation Goldeneye, and we had just gotten back from the front. The party, I say, you are all thoroughly exhausted by the time you reach Omega Base in your respective vehicles. Connor and Hex in the Jeep, Gent on the bike, later in the morning. Resting is the first thing on your mind. And so there's some talk about whether or not they still have the guy in the iron bands or not, and we established that they managed to get rid of them. Then we jump into... Everybody goes straight to bed, and we jump right to a dream sequence with Gent. Now, do you dream sequences much in your role-playing games, McGill?
It's pretty rare. Sometimes I've done them. It's the kind of thing where if I do dream sequences, they become kind of they factor into the formula of the game. Like, if I do a dream sequence early on, chances are there will be more dream sequences throughout that campaign. But I rarely do just like one or two. The exception though is anytime I do that adventure that I know I've talked about where people start getting pop-up ads in their dreams. Yeah. So. But yeah, not often. What about you? It doesn't seem like you do them too often.
I've done a fair share of dream sequences So we had the dream sequences with Methily about her backstory. We've had the dream sequences I'm not sure. I don't think that this is the first time Gent has had one of these dreams. I think this is the second in a sequence where previously she had had a dream. Right, because remember she asked Al Samasath, I think it was. She asked somebody and he was like, yeah, I know burbs, burb dreams. Burb dreams, burb dreams. Good dreams, like a good burb before a fight, but sometimes it's a bad burb before a fight. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I do remember that.
So, I don't know. I feel like I've done it a fair amount. Like, certainly relative to what you were saying, like, I definitely remember my fair share of dream sequences that I've run. I like them as a you know, mystical way of means of exposition. And of course I'm like, part of it is, really like really what's going on here is that, Gent picked up that tentacle flail when they did the writhing in the dark, remember? And having that is causing them to have weird dreams in association with it because they still have it on them. They've specifically not given it away to anybody or anything like that. And so I am having these dreams, but it's specifically tied to the demon lord Gratzt, who's very much like, he's sort of like the main villain of that season of the Adventurers League that Writhing of the Dark is from, that I've been using, as sort of an inspiration. And so, yeah, having Gent with that item and also having like the awareness that I am going to bring that demon lord into the scenario, I am sort of, that is the sort of exposition that's going on here. So, I say you find yourself standing before a tree that stands out to you. You see a blackbird upon its branches. You recognize it as the blackbird from your previous dream, but it seems slightly larger than before. Looking at its feet, you see that it now has 6 talons on each foot. What do you do? And Gent asks, do I have anything on me, like my bag of stuff? If so, I would like to offer it a shiny button. And it flies down, lands a few feet away from Gent. It stares at the button, then looks back to Gent. Gent replaces the button with a gold coin. The bird straightens up a bit and continues to observe Gent. Its gaze darting back and forth between Gent and the coin. Gent takes a step back and gives them space. The bird looks down at the coin, then back at Gent. Moves closer to the coin, standing over it, then stares at Gent. And Gent stares back and says, "What have you come for?" And the bird stares back at Gent for a moment, then suddenly it begins retching, and it begins vomiting up a torrent of gold coins that spews out towards Gent. And Gent says, on the other hand, on the one hand, that might have been tempting if it was buttons or bits of metal. Gent is just worried now. It will step closer to the bird again and pull out one of the health potions to offer. And as they approach the bird, they wake up. Hunger wakes the party around dinner time, and they regroup to enjoy a meal together served up by Hexaquila. And I ask what Hex makes this time. Meanwhile, Gent asks if they remember or know anything about a 6-toed blackbird. And I say they remember the dream, but they don't know anything about that specific image. Something about the image of the 6-toed bird is familiar, but otherwise doesn't mean anything to Gent after a little religion check with advantage. Hex serves up a bunch of cream of leek soup, and he also says maybe some little fried garlic slices and call it vichyssoise. I don't know how to say that word.
Vichyssoise.
Thank you, McGill. I was hoping somebody would know what the hell I'm saying. My brother bringing in the better...
That's like a cold soup.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a cream of leek soup with fried garlic slices, and it's a vichyssoise. So, after eating, Gent decides to write home to the college about the dream and the tentacle staff they found, and I say Gent is able to send their gem sample away to the college for investigation, but it will take a little bit for them to get back to them. That being the gem sample that they took from the, you remember in the previous message mission, they were told to grab a sample of these purple gemstones, and Gent was sure to get like extra samples to share with different people. So one of the things they do, they send away a bit of that sample of the purple gemstone. They have another sample that's ready for Coyote and another sample for Al. And they specifically do not send the tentacle flail to the college. What they do is they write a description of the bird and the flail to the college and request if they have any information available to share about these things. They also warn them of the pattern of demonic possessions and send them 1,000 gold, which brings Gent to a current total of 19,119. And then Gent says, oh, and 50 gold to the woman caring for my rust monster friends, ketchup, mustard, and relish. And I say, ha, make that 19,069 gold, to which everyone says, nice. I do mention that the rust monsters are not being cared for by one specific person, but it's like an animal place run by a few folks who are mostly elves. But Gent goes to Hex and Connor and asks if they know anything about blackbird symbols or images. And I have Hex and Connor both roll religion with advantage. And Connor says, I'm not that kind of priest. Hex gets a nat 20, though. And Hex's memory serves them best because he remembers previously seeing something like this. It's back in Citra Akra when they were infiltrating the demon-invaded territory with the mutant fire giants. There was a big statue of a hand with 6 fingers. And recalling this and jogging Connor's memory, the two of them worked together to remember that the idol was a symbol of the demon lord Gratz. So now I'm starting to pull it together for the players, is like, oh, I know this is where the symbol of like a 6-fingered hand, or potentially in the case of a bird, a 6-taloned bird. This is, it's all coming together as it's Gratz. And Connor says, did you say you saw that in your dreams? Better keep vigilant. The attention of a demon lord is a terrible thing. And Gent says, that name rings a bell. Is that the demon on the coin or a statue I got somewhere? Fuck, I've got too much stuff. And they say, it gave me a shit ton of coins, but that is about, but that's about it. And Gent starts emptying their bags and pockets of all items and things. I say, Gent, Gent was there when you saw the idol as well and would remember it at this point. The 6-fingered hand is the symbol of the Lord, Demon Lord Gratz. This is not your only item to feature this symbol. A big fang you picked up as a random trinket had the same marking, and you had had it analyzed by the college to gain similar insights. And Chantel says, as Chantel, I'm starting to feel like I do in my own life when I have so much shit I can't remember all of it and I just want to burn it all in a pile. Is the fang still with me or still at the college? And I say, apart from the symbol, you're able to learn more about Gratz. He is one of the most powerful known demon lords, rivaled only by perhaps Demogorgon or Arcus. And I say, it is. I think at this point, the college would have been able to send back the previous items with their analysis. And Gent says, at least it isn't a second-rate demon lord, only the best for me. I say, he's usually depicted as a tall, attractive, obsidian black humanoid. His concern is the realm of corruption, particularly in the form of addiction, base desire, impulse, and excess. He is also known by the title the Dark Prince. And Gent says, well, we can at least give Coyote and Al the rock samples now. And I say, of the demon lords, he's perhaps best known as a deceiver and schemer, which is rare among his kind. More the style of devils than demons. That said, there are no rules to the corruption that Gratz promotes, and mutation and chaos are always sure to follow in his wake. And I have everyone roll insight. And Hex gets a 17, Connor gets a 26, and Gent gets a nat 1, technically a 17, but truly a nat 1, and says, Gent is unperturbed by this information. I say, Connor sees the trends here. Magical influence, succubi and incubi, mutant fire giants, even your encounter with the insomnium addict seems more than a coincidence at this point. And Alex says, I believe we know who Agalloch has allied themselves with. And Chantel says, yeah, sexy demon. And I say, while many of your past experiences may have seemed unrelated, now they all seem to be part of one clear Gratz-related issue, from Citra Akra to the Art Octopus to Agalok. And filling in for Gent, I explain, just because Gent wasn't around for the Arctopus side of things. Back on the Arctopus, there was a plague of magic-based madness. There was the scheme involving the carnival to spread it around. All this stuff. So, big reveal. The players have just suddenly come to the revelation of, like, oh, man, this is totally all Gratz. Everything that's been happening for, like, the past three acts ties into, like, demonic corruption at the hands of this demon lord Gratz.
Oh, man. So behind the scenes, it was Gratz all along?
I'll say that what...
Gratz is the puppet master?
What Alex says about, like, I believe we know who Agalok has allied themselves with now, that is 100% on the money. That's Agalok is the one who is, like, that's why there are all these succubi and incubi infiltrating the, like, politics of the mantle.
Of course, yeah.
It's because this demon lord is, like, trying to take over, basically. And this, really what it is it goes back to In Citra Akra when they saw that abyssal sun portal leading to the abyss that was where the Carven Spire used to be. So there was the Carven Spire, which was the base of the Autumn Leaves back in Al's Aces. Then Al's Aces destroyed the Carven Spire at the end of Al's Aces, but it was full of portals to the Abyss. And so when they destroyed the Carven Spire, what Coyote's Aegis, what this party found out when they were in Citra Akra, was that in the absence of the Carven Spire, it was now just like this gaping maw to the Abyss, letting all these demons come through. But then through that gateway to the Abyss, Gratz came through from the Abyss into Citra Akra and then used the portals from Citra Akra to the Deathlands to get to the people of Agalok, and now he's trying to install himself in Drail.
So do they put all... How much of this do they put together at this point?
At this point, they have only put together, like, oh shit, Gratz is behind all this nonsense. But they don't know necessarily that he came through the Abyssal Maw through Citra Akra, although they might have figured that. I'm not sure. Because that certainly, like, it was when they were in Citra Akra that they were like, oh, there's this huge demon invasion going on, right? Like, it's not like they were unaware of the fact that demons were pouring into Citra Akra. And so, like, you know, then Citra Akra, that's the Nightside Eclipse right there. So the connection is pretty immediate of, like, Agalok being a Nightside Eclipse settlement, being connected to Citra Akra getting invaded by demons, therefore the demons spreading via Citra Akra to Agalok. Does that make sense?
It does. That ties together a lot. That's quite the revelation. It's neat. It's neat that we're having the revelation, but the characters haven't put it together yet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just giving you the behind the scenes so that you sort of know what's going on here, because, like, I'm doing the big reveal here, but yeah. They decide to go to the briefing room. Alex is like, Coyote needs to hear about this. I say, when you enter, you find the room surprisingly crowded. In addition to Coyote, you see several soldiers in the room, as well as the Ogre Commander Gog and the Orc Sergeant Morgar. These two most prominent Draelic military figures are across from each other around the table, which is now dominated by a map of Agalok like the one on the wall behind Coyote. Tokens are laid out on the table for use as indicators of potential military strategies on the map. Coyote waves to you as you enter. Greetings, friends. I understand you have good news for us. And Alex says, good news and bad. We've slain Lord Dio and his advisors and captured another high-ranking official. And the soldiers in the room gently cheer their report, much like the ones who were nearby when they reported to Sir Ram. And Gent holds out a purple rock to him. But then Alex continues, however, the evidence is clear that the allied Dio was waiting to meet with was none other than the demon lord Gratz. His advisors took on demonic forms when we attacked, Connor chimes in. Morgar grins broadly but quickly sets to laying out tokens on the map. Coyote then excuses himself from the table and comes around to approach the group. He gestures at the door, indicating for them to step into the hall with him so that he can speak to them in private. And Hex and Connor step out. Connor takes the shard of gemstone from Gent and says, "What's this?" And Gent says, "Was being collected, but I managed to sneak some back for us. Maybe it will be useful, or at least pretty." And Coyote says, "Might be worth taking to the labs, but they have a lot on their plate right now." He looks to Hex. "So they were attempting to meet with demons? Did you perform the assassination before the meeting could occur?" And they say, "Yes, an opportunity presented itself that could not be ignored. Gent managed to salvage some intel from their command tent." And I say, "As a reminder, the intel indicated plans to renegotiate treaties with the Nightside Eclipse." And Dent says, or Alex says, "And those crystals, they seemed like they might be meant as tribute to the Nightside Eclipse." And then they're like, "Oh, right, sorry, my bad. I remembered that as soon as I thought about that intel. It wasn't the rats they were meeting with. It was Nightside Eclipse." He says, "But nevertheless, what was the Nightside Eclipse settlement that sued for peace? Valfar met his ogre zombie pal there." And I say, "So it was a sequence of events, really. You guys secured the promise in Citra Akra that the Nightside Eclipse would cease support of their operations in Drail in order to deal with the greater issue of the demonic incursion. When they returned to Drail, this had apparently resulted in the Kingdom of Tristania turning on the Nightside Eclipse military leaders there. Those leaders, all vampires known to the Empok, then fled to the Arctopus with their remaining forces. So Tristania is no longer hostile, and the military leaders from the Nightside Eclipse active in that area have been taken out." And so Alex says, "Is it possible that Gratz has subverted control of the Nightside Eclipse in Citra Akra?" And Coyote thinks, "Based on reports, I mean, you were there. Do you think they could have made that much progress?" He says, "I'm not sure, but Gent's been having some troublesome dreams, and there's clearly some element of demonic interference in Agalloch. The documents we found, do indicate that Nightside Eclipse were expected to be at the meeting." And Coyote says, "It would fit Gratz's profile if he was using corrupted envoys from Citra Akra to sow discord." And Gent says, "It's a pattern of chaos and calamity." After a moment, Coyote says, "If anything, this seems like a reason to hurry up. Better we move on Agalloch before it turns into a potential demon party, or at least before they can entrench themselves." Coyote sighs. "I figure after all you've done for the Empok, I at least owe you this much. Things are moving fast." Coyote sighs again. "Gods know we can't slow them down, but I want to give you every opportunity to act on the knowledge we have. So what I'm saying is, we're going to war. Tomorrow. Very likely. I wouldn't feel right not giving you some advance warning. I know you've got lives beyond the Empok, families," and he looks around at them. "I would understand if this is too much to ask, but if it's not, well, you've got free reign of the teleporter room for tonight. Do whatever you each feel you need to do before going off to war. When you're ready, come back to the briefing room tomorrow." He gives them all a salute. Hex salutes back and then heads off to the teleporter room. Gent says, "That was a quick peace out." And Hex says, "Gotta see the wife if we're going to war. Make sure the house is in order, too." And I say, "I feel like Hex would, or I feel like Connor would seek the guidance of Paylor as well." And does Gent have any business they want to take care of or more to say to Coyote? And Gent says, "Not really. I think they study the tentacle staff since they have the space to themselves." And I say, "Okay, let's start with that then." And I have them roll Arcana with advantage on the tentacle flail. And I also, just because Gent keeps calling it the tentacle staff, I say it should be said it is not long enough to qualify as a staff. It's more like a rod. So Gent gets that classic 17. And I say, "So you don't have a lot of new insights studying the rod, but some things from before stick out to you a little more now. The dream started the first time you slept after getting this thing. When you woke up after the first dream, it seemed evident to you that the rod was the thing causing the dreams. Using that reasoning and what you know about Gratz, you begin to suspect a connection between the Demon Lord and the item. You got the flail from the Illithid that Alistair asked you to kill. Gent makes one of those crazy mystery walls. The Illithid had extra tentacles. Six? Six fingers? Six talons? Six tentacles? McGill? Crazy mystery wall?" And then Alex says, or she tries, but cannot resist the urge to collect up all the bits of string. And Gent says, I spend time making a conspiracy wall while Hex goes and gets laid. Meanwhile, Connor goes to his preferred temple of Paylor. And Gent certainly has more questions than answers now, but some that stand out include, why did Alistair ask you guys to hunt down an Illithid? Wasn't that kind of out of nowhere? What is the connection between the Illithid and Gratzt? What did the dreams mean, if anything? And Gent says, man, do I go and speak to Alistair on my own? And I say, you can try, but he is in hell. Might want to talk to HR about that one, a.k.a. Trey, the Illithid in charge of sentient resources at the MPOC. HR is also an Illithid. Alex says, HR is also an Illithid, so ixnay on the Erdermay. And I say, unless maybe Trey could shed some light. It's getting to be quite the layered mystery, it seems. And Gent takes a moment to think while Connor and Hex go. I say that as for Connor's preferred place of worship, I think there's a few candidates. There's a spot in the city of Decima in the Deathlands that he has some connection to, but his father used to preach in Stormgate, I believe, so returning there in its current state of cultural renaissance might be appealing to him. The only option that's still off the table is his hometown in the Wastelands. That said, I ask, do we want to do Hex or Connor first? And so we go with Hex first, because he's more sure of that one. And Hex returns to his big city home in Stormgate. I say, Noah is glad to see you and embraces you upon your return. Staying safe, I hope? She asks with a smile. He says, grim tides, I'm afraid. Things are ramping out in the south. Lots of action ahead. How's the house treating you? She says, well, the city never lacks for entertainment. Are you worried? He says, mostly for your sake. And Hex pulls out a bag and drops it on the table. 5,000 gold pieces settle heavily inside, in case anything happens. There's something strange going on this time. Any news from our little spell slinger? She smiles and reassures Hex. As long as you have your friends there, I suspect they'll keep you out of harm's way. And some. Not so little, of course. He seems to show promise from what his teachers tell me. I mostly hear from them through sending spells. As you know, he's not fond of the written word. I'm sure at some point I'll get a sending from him, and that will certainly be exciting. And Hex blinks. He never sends me. He checks his stone. No missed messages. Geez, what makes you so special? He ribs Noah gently. Noah laughs and says, again, they don't come from him directly. They're more just check-ins from his teachers. I suspect they imagine I'm more able to receive them, given your line of work. That may change when he learns the spell for himself, though. And Hex says, fair point. Anyways, what do you want for dinner? I've got an idea for a dish. Salted veal and boiled blood sausage. That's a reference to the salted seas of boiling blood that border the Stormgate.
Oh, yes.
And sorry,
which band is that? That's
Upon Salted Seas of Boiling Blood. That's Black Dahlia Murder.
Black Dahlia Murder. See, that just always makes me think of Blood Ocean from Metalocalypse. So I can never keep it in my head.
Oh, the song is called On Stirring Seas of Salted Blood. But also, the thing about that is that also, there's another song, I think it's even on the same album, that's called Carbonized in Cruciform. And, that's also a tie-in because on the shores of the salted seas of boiling blood on the northern side have been cursed so that if you step on them, it's like a minefield where crucifixes of carbonite shoot out from the ground and impale you so that you get crucified. Oh, wow. By carbonite, which is a play on carbonized and cruciform. It's absurdity.
Dizzying, Tom. It's dizzy. You need a wiki for this world.
So Noah says that the salted veal and boiled blood sausage sounds great. We switch over to she reveals that she's been working to stock the wine cellar, collecting fine vintages when she can from the bustling market Stormgate now boasts. Then we jump over. Oh, Yeah, we jump over to Connor. I say, does Connor undergo any particular ritual or ceremony? And Alex says, I imagine his night starts with a trip to his favorite tobacconist in Stormgate. Picks up 6 or 7 Cohibas for the road ahead. And he'd sit on the steps of the temple and smoke one quietly before heading in. The sky seems brighter than it's ever been. It feels like Stormgate is entering a better age just as surely as the Deathlands. Once inside, Connor finds a quiet spot to meditate and commune with Paylor. In the quiet darkness of his meditation, Connor feels the voice of Paylor himself enter his mind. Connor Bloomheart, welcome. Almighty Paylor, I come to you tonight on the eve of war with some doubt in my mind. I have questions to ask of you. An image fills Connor's mind of a dawn horizon. The voice seems to reach out from the light. Ask. Can Agaloc be saved? Can these people ever be brought into your light? It is clear to me that the darkness of the abyss is being led into the world through them. And if the people were driven out, what of those demons would linger there? I fear this war might be foolish. And Connor feels as though the horizon smiles back at him. You have already plunged into the darkness headfirst once before. You have emerged to see the changing era in Drail. My light shines through the darkness that once enveloped the Deathlands already. Should it not stand to reason that it would take one more plunge to bring my light to the remaining dark places in Agaloc? And Connor replies, in my travels I have come across hellfire pits, great scars of infernal energy blasted across the landscape, all in the name of this quest. What legions do we invite in a war with demons? What worth will be left in Agaloc? Is it doomed to become another waking nightmare of deep woods and skittering shapes? And, in response, Paylor says, do not limit the scope of your vision. All of Drail has been afflicted, and soon all of Drail shall be cured, for better or worse. This world is changing, and when the darkness clears, my light will not be the only difference. And the horizon begins to tremble, and Connor sees a vision of the map of Drail. But light will find no purchase if the darkness is not dispelled, if the world is not liberated. As he says darkness, the vision changes to the map of Citra Akra. Then, as he speaks of the world's liberation, Connor sees that geometric map of Citra Akra overlaid over the continent of Drail. The vision of the horizon returns. It seems the sun is slowly rising. One more plunge, and you will emerge in a new world. You just need to be there to save it. Connor understands this last message on multiple levels. There being the world, but also the darkness. Being there to save it, meaning the MPOC, but also the Draelic military. And of course, meaning you. And so Alex asks, when I saw the overlaid images of Drail and Citra Akra, where was Citra Akra centered? Over the destroyed shipyard? And that's a callback all the way back to MPOC's Finest, back when one of the first jobs they did before they hunted the Nightside Eclipse was a big Nightside Eclipse shipyard that was being built on the east coast of Drail in the Westlands. You can still see it on the map of Drail. It's sort of just like a marked out ruin of a shipyard. But that's a big one way back. And as the sun rises, Connor opens his eyes to find himself in the glare of a sunbeam streaming through the temple window. And Connor mutters, well, time for a stronger smoke. It's a bit tough to pinpoint. Are you looking at a map of Drail, I ask? And Connor says, on his way out of the temple, he throws 1,000 gold in the coffers. And he begins looking at the map of Drail, the same one that you can find on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com, on the top page. And I say, it's around the east side of the channel, close to Settlers Green, Murder Mountain, and the destroyed shipyard. Would be where the center of Citra Akra's map would be. And that's also the map of Citra Akra that you can get in the same place. So if you imagine that weird octagonal map of Citra Akra being overlaid over the map of Drail, with the middle being put somewhere like around the channel that cuts through Drail, with the center being the Omni-Lich, anyways, all of this to say, Connor has had this vision of Drail and Citra Akra, the two maps being overlaid. And it certainly puts ideas in Alex's head, because he immediately starts looking at those maps and asking questions about, like, wait, so where is it centered then? And, like, where is everything falling? After that, Connor makes his way to Hex's house and totally drops by for dinner unannounced. He, Hex, and Noah will get wine drunk, play Deathlands craps into the wee hours. And with that, I say, the image in Connor's mind of Citra Akra overlaid over Drail kind of makes it look like the octagonal grid of the, or the octagonal shape of the Citra Akra map is like imprisoning Drail or caging it. But apparently Paylor's pretty convinced that Connor can set it free. And that is where we decided to break.
Oh man. So, fitting this into the grander arc of the three acts of the MPOC's Finest Nightside Eclipse campaign tapestry, where are, like, it really does feel like the events of this are teeing up the home stretch, right?
Yeah, and like to some extent they very much are. Like really this is kind of, now that we've cleared all the stuff, like the goblins in egg, like the goblins in Agalloch, the mushrooms in Agalloch, the myconids in Agalloch, the masquerade ball, the assassination, writhing in the dark, all of that. That is kind of like, you know, it's kind of all there so that they can have this moment of like, oh wait, like putting all the pieces together and being like, oh, there's been something to do with Gratz or with demons with every one of these things that we've done. And with that revelation, it sort of leads them into the like end or the climax of this act, which is basically the full liberation of Agalloch. Like, they are going to be going in now with the Draelic military and fully, like, launching an invasion of Agalloch and, like, fighting the Battle of the Mantle and everything. And that is
going
to be...
Are they going up against Grazd?
Man, spoiler alert, but yes, the final boss of this act is actually a battle with Gratz, the Demon Lord himself. And it, again, actually, that is how this season of the Adventurers League ends as well. But then with that finishes the act. And then it is the thing of like, there is one last act remaining, which is like, now we have to initiate Odium and the Cult of One's plan in Citra Akra. And that is like, that is what I am still kind of like on hiatus for in present time. And, but that is like the end of this, campaign as it's planned out.
Man, that's exciting. That's really cool. I can't wait to hear what happens next. I feel like what we've done is you and I have, inadvertently followed Hitchcock's rules of suspense, right?
In what way?
Well, like, now I know all these details that the characters don't. And so the tension for me is going to be watching or hearing you describe the revelations that they have, bringing them closer and closer to the knowledge that I now have.
Right.
You know, it's Hitchcock would say to create tension, you put a bomb under someone's seat, but the character doesn't know, the audience knows.
Yeah, I think that, like, this is the benefit for us talking about it in retrospect as Dungeon Masters is, like, well, we have the benefit, you have the benefit of me being able to tell you this is how close, like, this is the ending that I have in mind, and this is how close we are to it. But to the players, like, The thing that's really weighing on the players at this point in the game is, like, I just told them, like, you're going back to war, basically. Like, this is going to be serious, like, you know, I guess really it's not back to war for these characters, because what I'm thinking of, really, I'm kind of getting mixed up thinking of the characters from Al's Aces and when they took part in the liberation of the Deathlands. But, like, there is a certain level of gravity where it's like, okay, well, you're not just going on a mission this time. Like, this is, you are going to be going to a battle now, and, like, people are going to die. Like, there are going to be losses, sort of thing. So you should definitely, you know, spend time with your loved ones ahead of time. Also, just in the chat here, I have included some pictures, portraits I was using for Morgar and Commander Gog, the military figures in the Draelic army that they saw gathered in the briefing room in today's session.
Who's the first guy? I recognize this artist. Why would I recognize this artist, Tom?
It's definitely one of the orcs from Warhammer 40K.
Yeah.
That art is Morgar, the orc gunnery sergeant. Sergeant Morgar and nice. Commander Gog.
Well, they look great.
But yeah, mainly just a downtime session where we cover a lot of, like, you know, we cover looking back on what has happened so far and sort of gleaning insights from that, but also looking ahead to what's coming and sort of saying, like, all right, well, things are going to get pretty intense here, so, you know, smoke if you got them, sort of thing.
Yeah, I liked that. I liked the smoke if you got them, not even that. It was sort of like, you know, say goodbye to your loved ones.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, I should say, while we're on the subject, is that thing, that image of Citra Akra overlaid over Drail, that is an idea that I had had for some time, and it's an image that, like, I implied, I wanted to throw in as just, like, a very kind of cryptic bit of foreshadowing, but that image is actually really, really important and ends up being really important in the next act specifically. Do you ever give your players, like, a cryptic clue of something or something that you're not sure they'll, like, you don't think they'll, like, tie together its larger meaning, but then they actually do?
Oh, man. I mean, I'm sure it's happened. I can't think of a ready instance. But, like, I feel like something like Mines and Metal and Wheels was a campaign where in order to make the time travel work in the second Mines and Metal and Wheels campaign, I had to do a lot of, like, planning out of clues and Easter eggs and things that I could seed throughout the early game so that when the players would travel back in time, they would suddenly click into place and make sense. So I've definitely done that kind of thing, but I can't think of, like, an example of one where I gave it to them not expecting them to figure it out and they still did.
Yeah, like, the thing is that in the next act, when the thing that vision is relevant to comes up, it pretty much immediately jumps out in Alex's mind, and he's like, oh, this reminds me of that vision. And, like, he even sort of gets what it means in that context to some extent, I think. Meanwhile, I have another example of the opposite happening, which is just recently when we were running Teeth, I had Glad Peter give you guys a weird cryptic message, and you guys played right into his weird cryptic message and didn't see through it at all. So I was real happy about that.
Yeah, yeah, gosh, Glad Peter. I was really trying to figure out. So, well, no, I won't ask you questions about a game I'm actually playing. Maybe when it's over, we can dissect it and do the postmortem.
I mean, I don't know. I'm willing to answer your questions, but
I guess you can tell me this. So those cryptic messages, those were like riddles with actual answers, because I started to feel like maybe he was just a crazy NPC.
I mean, the real thing was that they weren't good riddles, right? Like, he said that, like, to say that to leave a place twice is to leave and leave like a tree, that's kind of a crazy thing to say. Like, you can sort right. of see what he's saying, but it's also kind of gibberish, right? So, which I think is, like, a good balance to strike with Glad Peter, because, like, he's not a sensible guy who's just like, ooh, riddles. He's kind of like a nutcase, lives in the wilderness. Does that answer your question?
Well, that's the impression. Yeah, that's the impression I got anyway, is that he was just crazy.
Like, there is some rhyme to it, but not a whole lot. And then I had him do that nonsense.
There's some rhyme, but not a lot of reason.
Then I had him do that nonsense riddle. The one...
Okay, yeah. So that's just it. The nonsense riddle was the thing that made me go like, oh, maybe the first one was just him being crazy.
The first one has as much... the first one is as meaningful as saying, make like a tree and leave, basically.
Right.
Whereas the second one is just him saying, like, oh, I like riddles, and then saying a nonsense riddle. But a nonsense riddle that is known the internet over, my friend.
Make like a tree and leave?
No, the one with Shrub Ruster.
Oh, right.
Wind Slave, yeah. Many man scud... many man scud thumper, maker of worn wood, shrub ruster, sky mocker, rave with an exclamation mark, portly pusher, wind slave, what am I? And the answer is the ocean. I mean, it's on the internet.
I get if there's a really strong breeze, I tend to fall over, so maybe I'm the portly pusher wind slave.
And maybe
Maybe it's me, Tom.
Maybe I'm the damn shrub ruster. Okay, that's a lot of nonsense. But yeah.
Yeah, we are becoming Glad Peter. We're descending into gibberish ourselves.
Yeah, any questions about that downtime or anything else like that? I feel like we dug pretty into it. You were pretty interested in, like...
Yeah, exactly. I'm excited to see what comes next. Because, like I said, I feel like we're launching into something really climactic and consequential.
Yeah, we've certainly we've got Battles of Aegaloc to look forward to. We got that much to look forward to. So I think that's it for our episode, eh?
Yeah,
a short one. If you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Comparing Campaign. We're Comparing Campaign on Facebook. Or if you want to see our supplemental materials and show notes, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. We got to update that website, though. I was looking at it. So, you know, hopefully I'll have that updated in the future. Yeah, I don't know who's got an outro for this episode. Not me.
Roll on your table, and maybe you can escape Rome without getting burned, or you can manage to get rid of your mastodon, or maybe you'll kill your nemesis, even though you kind
of... More likely, you're just going to burn down in a series of adding numbers, you know? You add a number here, you add a number there, and oops, it's over. The podcast is over. We hit 10.